Belgium is currently enjoying the second week of a new national government. This would be entirely unremarkable were it not for the fact that the seven-party coalition agreed circa the crack of dawn the other Wednesday ended 493 days without a national government. And this was not even Belgium's first such era of anarchy in recent times. Belgium went 589 days without a national government between 2010 and 2011. These protracted standoffs are partially a product of Belgium's infernally intricate political order. Though barely bigger than the American states of Massachusetts or Vermont, and with a population smaller than Greater Los Angeles, even when Belgium doesn't have a national government, it still has three regional governments, parliaments for the French-speaking community and the German-speaking community, 10 provincial governments, and not fewer than 581 municipal councils. There's also a king, should one be needed. But that infernally intricate political order is also the consequence of, and a means of dealing with, Belgium's more fundamental complexities. Belgium, though small, is also several even smaller nations neighbouring and overlapping each other. At the most recent election, back in 2019, the two biggest shares of the vote for the federal parliament were won by parties who don't think Belgium should even really exist: the moderate Flemish nationalists of the New Flemish Alliance and the far-right Flemish firebreathers of Vlaams Belang. One reason it has taken so long to put a new government together is the difficulty of assembling a coalition which excludes both of them. But is this just an exercise in postponing the problem rather than solving it? Is there the remotest chance that keeping nationalists out of power will actually render nationalism less powerful? Is Belgium, in its present form, ultimately doomed? This is the Foreign Desk.
This system, this way of working, you cannot hold it on the long term. It's impossible. It's exhausting. So Belgium cannot stay like this. We need to move forward. We need to face the health crisis, socioeconomic crisis. We cannot lose time and energy all the time on this linguistic conflict and divide. Innovative solutions need to be found. What's left of Belgium needs stability in the future.
They are aiming already at this point toward the next election, arguing that because the new government has barred them from power, that it only shows how Belgium is continuing to wrestle with demands for right-wing policy, for more autonomy in the north. So we are expecting very fierce opposition from both Flemish nationalist parties.
After the 2010 elections, when Belgium broke the world record of cabinet formation, at that moment, people really thought this will be the end of Belgium. But it did not. We just kept moving on. I think that is the destiny of Belgium.
Hello and welcome to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined today by the political scientists Karl De Vos and Régis Dandois. Karl De Vos is a professor at Ghent University. Régis Dandois is a research fellow and guest lecturer at the University of Brussels. Karl, I'll start with you. I think these sagas of Belgium's periods of non-government do have a certain mesmerizing effect on global opinion. People are very curious about it. So, first of all, has not having a government all this time actually made any appreciable difference to anything?
Well, not that much, because we simply always have a government. Even if it's not supported by a parliamentary majority, we still have a government. For instance, after an election and before the formation of a new government is finished, we have a caretaker government. And a caretaker government means that the government can do whatever is needed for daily management of current affairs or even manage a crisis. So Belgium really isn't ever without a government. But indeed, we had a caretaker government in the past few months, even more than a few months, almost more than a year. With the arrival of the new De Croo government, people suddenly awoke and concluded, well, yes, it is quite useful to have a government. For instance, in the management of the pandemic, for the first time since more than a year, we see a strong prime minister. We see a strong minister of health that are taking decisions, that are communicating with the people, that are showing themselves that they are leading the country. And this was something that we missed for more than a year now. So it really makes a difference, even that most of us does not really feel it on an everyday basis if you had or do not have a government.
Reggie, on that subject of the pandemic in particular, has that been an area in which Belgians really have noticed the lack of an official, proper, sworn-in national government? Has it struck you that that has dictated Belgium's response to the pandemic at all?
Yeah, indeed, it was very difficult at the beginning. We had a caretaker government since the end of 2018, and Belgium had to face the most important health crisis of its history. So the situation was a bit weird because on the one side, you had a political crisis that was put into parentheses while there was still a health and the beginning of a socioeconomic crisis. So maybe the first weeks, Belgium was a bit slow in the response because they did not know how to structure the response, because Belgium is a complex country. You have different levels of government. So you always have to discuss between the federal level and the regions and the communities. And then you had this political crisis on top of that. So it may be that the response was not that coordinated during the first days, first week of the crisis, but then it went very fast in terms of putting all the strength, all the forces in the crisis. So during a few months, we had some kind of a national spirit, which is some kind of unique, if you go back in the last decades of the history of Belgium. Such a spirit of collaboration between levels of government and between parties from the majority, from the opposition at different levels of governments, is quite unique.
We will be talking later in the show about the idea of a national spirit in Belgium and what that might look like now and in the future. But for the moment, let's talk a bit about this new government. It is led, Carl, by the new Prime Minister, Alexander De Croo. Could you briefly explain who he is and how he got there?
Well, Alexander De Croo is quite experienced. He has been in several federal governments in the past few years. He's probably one of the most experienced members of the new government, because one of the typical characteristics of that new government is that it's composed with many new ministers that we have never seen before. So it's a quite new, fresh government. Secondly, he has been the former president of the Flemish Liberal Party. He's been considered as a rather right-wing liberal, a liberal not in the philosophical way of thinking, but in the party partition way of thinking. He's a more a free market liberal. He is a good communicator, and he has the image of being a bit of a leader. He brings people together. But one of the main reasons why Alexander De Croo became the prime minister is not because of what I just described, but mainly because he's from Flanders, he's Flemish. And after three French-speaking prime ministers, we had Sophie Wilmès, we had Charles Michel, and before that we had Elodie Rupo. So in a federal country in which the northern part, Flanders, has the largest population, about 60% of total population of Belgium, it was considered that it is now time again to have a Dutch-speaking prime minister, because in Belgium, balance is important.
Reggie, he seems to have been very careful to balance his government in all sorts of other respects, though. As Carl's saying, he has banked fairly heavily on youth. He's clearly worked on having something approaching gender balance within his government. He has appointed Europe's first, I think I'm right in saying, transgender deputy prime minister. That's Petra de Sutter. Is he trying to make a statement there about an inclusive idea of Belgium?
Yes, definitely. The idea is to show that Belgium belongs to the 21st century, that traditional politics is behind us, that the traditional ways of appointing ministers, of managing the cabinets, of negotiating between parties belongs to the past. And that now, not only with the renewed team, but maybe with a different way of communicating, a different way of discussing between parties and discussing with the different levels of governments, is that Belgium is becoming a more modern and progressive state. I think this is also something that unites the different parties, because some of them wanted to have improvements of social policies or economic policies, but most of them share this idea of renewal of the way politics was made in Belgium. And what better way of showing this renewal of the political landscape than appointing a different type of minister? As you mentioned, more females. Now we have a majority of female ministers in the Council of Ministers, more young ministers and people with different profile. So I think this is a very important way of communicating that this government is different than the previous one and is able to enter and to make Belgium enter the 21st century.
Carl De Vos and Reggie Standois, thank you both for the moment. We will have more from you later in the show. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. Between now and Belgium's next federal election due in 2024, the new government will face a formidable opposition. Not just the largest party in Parliament, but also the equal second largest. The new Flemish Alliance and Vlaams Belang don't necessarily like each other all that much, but they do both subscribe to some idea of Flemish nationalism, even Flemish separatism. Well, joining me from Brussels with more on that is Barbara Moons, reporter at Politico Europe. Barbara, we'll start at the start, I guess. Are there generally agreed origins of the idea of Flemish nationalist sentiment, where it started and why it started?
Yeah, the Flemish nationalist sentiment go back for centuries, actually, to the beginning of Belgium and even before that. But I think the main thing or the interesting thing to know is that Belgium was always more dominated by the French-speaking culture. And so it took quite some time in order to have, for example, Flemish education, Flemish culture, the recognition of the Flemish language as an official language that is also equally respected. It was actually during the First World War where a lot of Flemish soldiers were sent to war and had to take orders from French officers that they often didn't understand, which obviously, I mean, led to huge mistakes and to a lot of resentment with Flemish nationalists, even if they weren't called that at that point. And that went throughout the Second World War. And it wasn't really until after, so mid-20th century, also because the economics within Belgium shifted. So you had that sense of, you know, this cultural nationalism, but also the economic nationalism, because throughout the mid-20th century, the wealth that was being produced in Belgium kind of shifted from the French-speaking part, Wallonia, towards Flanders. And Flanders is now by far the more richer region of the two. So in that sense, it also help grew the self-esteem of Flanders to say that you have to respect our language, our culture, especially since we're now paying the bills.
Given that transformation of Flanders that you describe, is Flemish nationalism now actually really descended from that historical Flemish nationalism, or is it something new entirely? This seems to sound like a transition from the nationalism of the underdog to the nationalism of the overdog, I guess.
Yeah, it's true. And I mean, the political parties that we have now really go back to that roots. They were called differently throughout the time, but they really go back to those Flemish national roots. And in that sense, I mean, for some, it is still an economic nationalism. You know, they say that it's not fair that Flanders is paying certain bills for the French-speaking part of Wallonia. But with a lot of people within the Flemish nationalist parties, it's also very cultural nationalism and a very sensitive issue that sometimes goes back decades within certain families that were, for example, mistreated by French-speaking citizens.
So the two Flemish nationalist parties, which are now preeminent and which did do very well in the 2019 election, this is Vlaams Belang and the new Flemish Alliance. What are the differences between them?
There are big differences, actually. So you have the far-right Vlaams Belang or Flemish Interest Party, which is closely aligned to other far-right forces in Europe, like the French National Rally, Italy's League Party. And they run, like you said, they won very big in the 2019 elections, actually to the surprise of many. So that's the first one, Flemish Interest, so the far right. And then you have the new Flemish Alliance, which is more conservative party, which aligns itself with parties like the Tories and is at this point the largest party, not just in Flanders, but overall in Belgium. And so they are more focused, even though they have these Flemish national roots that we talked about, they are more focused on the economic nationalism part. So they want to have more autonomy for Flanders, but mostly to say that we can at least manage our own affairs, for example, when it comes to healthcare, when it comes to pensions. So that's the big difference between those two parties.
Do they, though, and I know this is the aspect that I think bemuses most foreign onlookers who can't quite understand how this would actually work. Do they literally want to secede from Belgium and establish Flanders as a new independent nation?
Yeah, that was definitely the historic goal. It's still openly the goal of the far-right Flemish Interest Party, When it comes to the conservative New Flemish Alliance, it is officially still their goal. I mean, it's in their party documents. But when you ask them about it, and I mean, they've obviously been asked a lot about this publicly, their party position at this point is that independence for Flanders, even if it would be within the European umbrella, which would be a very hard thing to do, because then obviously you have other regions, not to talk about Catalonia or others, who would might have wanted to do the same. But so even if that would be a possibility within Europe, they agree that at this point it might not be the best option because of all the, you know, logistical obstacles, etc. I mean, I don't have to refer to Brexit, but so at this point, what they want is more autonomy for Flanders, so more regional competences. They call it confederalism, but they are not striving for autonomy in the short term.
So how is all this seen in non-Flanders Belgium? Is it taken seriously? Is it a source of concern and discussion?
Yeah, of course, especially because at this point, we kind of have the rule in Belgium that no other party will govern with the far-right Flemish interests. But given their big win in the last election, that obviously complicates the search for a coalition government. Because obviously, when you look at it from the Walloon French-speaking perspective, it's scary if the biggest part of the country is looking for more autonomy or even more independence in the long term. So it's definitely seen with concern. Also because of the economic arguments that I mentioned, you know, if Flanders would become independent, that would just be a huge financial problem for the southern part of the country.
Is there now, or is there growing, any kind of answering sentiment in Wallonia? Is there now a Walloon nationalist movement?
Yeah, there has been historically, absolutely. There are also movements within Wallonia who kind of strive to maybe become a part of France. But at this point, those are pretty minor movements, so to say. So the main political mainstream parties are not really looking for more autonomy or more independence. So at this point, we don't really have that. The main strive for more autonomy or more independence really comes from the northern part.
So we do have this situation now where the two parties which did best in the most recent federal election have been excluded from the national government. How are they going to spend their time in opposition?
They are aiming already at this point toward the next election, so that is in 2024, arguing that because the new government has barred them from power, that it only shows how Belgium is continuing to wrestle with demands for right-wing policy, for more autonomy in the north. So we are expecting very fierce opposition from both Flemish nationalist parties.
Barbara Moons, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. Still with me are Carl DeVos and Régis Dandois. In this part of the show, I want to try and look ahead to the future, not just of this new Belgian coalition, but of Belgium's national institutions as a whole. Régis, you were saying in the first part of this programme how this new government is trying to forge a new idea of Belgian politics. It's trying to leave certain things of the past behind. Does it think of the Flemish Walloon schism as something that can be left behind? Or do people generally accept that it's part of Belgian politics and you just need to deal with it?
No, you cannot leave that behind. It's part of the core nature of Belgian politics. It's been present since the very beginning, since the creation of the Belgian state about two centuries ago. And probably it will remain like this until the end of Belgium or the end of whatever we know. So no government, no national government has ever been able to fully manage and soften the linguistic divide or the community divide, as we call it in Belgium. The way they negotiate the balance of power between the different ministers, everything turns around this idea of opposing or balancing French-speaking and Dutch-speaking. So the one clue of a stability of a national government in Belgium is this management of these crises, of these linguistic conflicts. If you cannot manage it on a daily basis, while you deal with other issues, then your government is doomed to collapse. So it's very important that you have to keep that in mind, that it will never disappear, and that you have to manage your country and your cabinet despite on this heavy burden.
Carl, is there not a danger, though, that if you exclude from government, as this government has not just the two biggest Flemish nationalist parties, but as of the last election, the two actual biggest parties, that that does not accentuate the divide even further, that it increases the resentments that, that drive a divide like that in the first place?
It is a danger, because so one of the very strong arguments in Flanders against the federal government was that it does not represent the majority of Flemish people. If you exclude the first and the second largest party of a country, that's quite exceptional. And why it is important? Because in Flanders, the majority has the feeling that they are not represented by the federal government. The danger is that on the longer term, this government could be considered as no longer legitimate. And so if the the Cruel One government is not carefully looking at what happens in Flanders, which is more like a center-right region, the French-speaking part of Belgium is politically speaking more on the center-left, Flanders is more on the center-right. So if the government does not take into account that the majority of the Flemish people have rather center-right feelings, and this is not seen in policy or decision, whatever, it could lead to an alienation between the dominant forces in the Flemish public opinion on the one side and the federal government on the other side, which will result at the end of the day in more regionalistic feelings, more demands for more regional power and competences at the Flemish side. It's been widely understood that in the next few years, there will be no great discussions about reforming the state. But we all expect that on the next election day, 2024, the big debate, yet again, another one, another big debate about what should we do with Belgium will be on the agenda. And that another reform of the state, the seventh one, will be on the agenda. That's something that we cannot avoid, like Régis just indicated. It is a continuous, never-ending conflict management in a very, very strange country. Belgium is a very peculiar country. It is a holding together federation without national media, without national parties, without national education, without a national language. So everything that you normally need to socialize citizens inside an identity is missing. We have a common history, but we have clear differences, and we are condemned to one another to live together, but to continuously try to work out these problems.
Rishi, does that process of ongoing crisis management that Carl describes strike you as something that can actually be maintained forever? Is there serious concern in Belgium, do you think, perhaps even growing concern, that it might just reach a point of irrecoverable crisis and the country might split? Other European countries have, well within recent memory. Does Belgium have to be the exception?
Yeah, the political consensus or the consensus of the main actors is that this system, this way of working is not, you cannot hold it for on the long term. It's impossible. It's exhausting. Parties and actors are exhausted always to talk about the same topics. So in the north of the country, in Flanders, some parties, yes, want to secede from Belgium. They want their independence. In the south of the country, the situation was not that clear. Whether they would like to keep a united Belgium or whether they want to have more autonomy. But more and more, they're realizing that the future of Belgium needs to be decided soon. We cannot keep on like this for decades, and a solution needs to be found. And this idea of independent Flanders, yes, is growing in both sides of the country. The idea is that ultimately, there will be nothing left of Belgium. Ultimately, that we will have to concede to the Flemish demands. And so minds of people are changing, but definitely Belgium cannot stay like this. We need to move forward. We need to face the health crisis, socioeconomic crisis. We need to be a full European actor. We cannot lose time and energy like this all the time on this linguistic conflict and divide, which makes no sense in the 21st century. There are plenty of other ways to associate regions and communities outside of a federal government, and then innovative solutions needs to be found, and Belgium needs stability, or what's left of Belgium, or the states that would come out of Belgium need stability in the future.
Carl.
I fully agree with what Régis just said on one particular point. Often it is thought that in the north, in Flanders, where two Flemish nationalist parties are very strong, the Vlaams Belang and the N-VA, which have a clear separatist agenda. They want a independent Flanders. So many people think that in Flanders, since both parties are so popular, there is a vast majority of citizens, of Flemish citizens, that really want the end of Belgium, really want the independence of Flanders. This is not the case. It maybe sound very strange, but even if you look at people voting for the Vlaams Belang or N-VA, people voting for these Flemish nationalist parties, there is no majority at all inside that group of voters that want an independent Flanders. Using opinion polls or whatever, if you ask Flemish citizens, do you want Flanders to be independent? A vast and quite stable majority of Flemish people say, no, we do not want an independent Flanders. What they want, what they need, and that holds the same for the people living in Brussels and Wallonia, is we need to talk about Belgium in order to change Belgium, maybe less Belgium, more powers for the regional governments, for Flanders, Wallonia, and Brussels, but not the end of Belgium. So I'm not that convinced that there is a final destiny at the end of history, which concludes only to the end of Belgium. We will have a seventh reform of the state, and it will always be the same story. Less Belgium, more regional government, and maybe an eighth one, maybe a ninth one. But Regie and I, we all know that it is very difficult to define in advance what will be the particular point on which stability will be reached. At a certain point in history, would it be possible to say, now all of us are happy. Now this is exactly the kind of state structure that we want. We are not there yet. But after the 2010 elections, when Belgium broke the world record of cabinet formation, 541 days, it took us 541 days before making a government. At that moment, people really thought this is the end of it. This will be the end of Belgium. But it did not. The only way out was a very traditional, very classical reform of the state, very complex, not understandable agreement between political parties. And we just kept moving on like we will do after the 2024 elections. I think that is the destiny of Belgium.
Regie, is there then an idea of Belgium that you can imagine all the communities of Belgium ever coalescing around? Carl was talking earlier about that extraordinary lack of national institutions and national pillars and national signifiers that Belgium has, that most countries regard as the furniture of their nationality. Are there things that strike you as things that Belgium comes together around, whether it's, I don't know, the king or the football team? Is there anything there that can perhaps be built upon?
Yeah, indeed, you have some national symbols, like you mentioned, the national football team or the king or the Belgian fries or the beers. But they
well, the national football team only if they win, because if they lose, people ask, is it a Walloon or a Flemish player that just kicked outside of the goal? That's when they win, we love them. When they lose, then they become Flemish or French speaking.
Yes, but they remain symbols. They do not contribute to for keeping Belgium together, for holding Belgium together. What keeps Belgium together, first of all, it's history, its institutions that are designed in a way to manage this conflict. So yes, we do have a linguistical community conflict, but it remains only at the elite level. So it does not include the society, it does not include the populations. There are no problems in terms of population, not only because they are concentrated on territories and they have few contacts with each other, but because they really don't care about these linguistic issues and problems. And also the fact that populations look like each other, even though they talk a different language. If you talk with companies, some companies do market studies, and they say, well, a Walloon or French-speaking Belgians look more like a Flemish than a Frenchman, and a Flemish look more like a Walloon than a Dutchman or woman. Because in terms of behavior, consumer behavior, in terms of habits, we look the same. We don't speak the same language. We don't talk to each other. But still today, we look like each other. Maybe in a few generations, you know, let's look at the younger generation. Maybe they grow apart. But for the moment, this also helps holding the country together.
If I look at Belgium, I see a couple have been married for many years now, even decades, I presume, that are not that really happy with their marriage, but they have children and they have a house. And they prefer the certainty of the known problems above the uncertainty of what happened when they divorce. Because you could imagine that they will become more happier if they divorce, but at the same time, they could end up very lonely and very unhappy. So that's why they stick together. Maybe the marriage it's not that happy, but they prefer it above the loneliness or the adventure of a divorce and the money it will cost. So let's stick together, you know, for the children and the house that we just bought.
Well, on that semi-cheerful note, Karl De Vos and Régis Dandois, thank you both very much for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Yolin Goffin and edited by Christy Evans and Jack Jewers. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening, and until next time, goodbye.